Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Today we are continuing with our monthly POTUS 47 series of conversations as we recently surpassed a milestone for the second Trump administration, the 100-day mark. We are fortunate to have with us again for the conversation, Kurt Ryman, Head of Fixed Income Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. Kurt is joining us today to provide some reflections, takeaways from the first 100 days of the second Trump administration, as well as share some thoughts in terms of what the road ahead may have in store for policy and the impacts to the economy and markets. With that, Kurt, thank you for dropping by Top of the Morning today to spend some time with our listeners, our clients. A lot to cover, so looking forward to hearing your insights today.
Likewise. Thanks a lot, Dan, for having me back on the show.
So, Kurt, as we're recording today on Thursday, May 8th, at this point, we are roughly a week past President Trump's 100-day mark of his second term in office. There is much, of course, we can reflect on, though, looking at the president's approval rating, what's it indicative of in terms of how the American voter feels at the moment, and how does it compare against 100 days into President Trump's first term in office?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great start. When you think about these first 100 days and the polling numbers, it's a rather inauspicious start where at the start of his term, he was polling above 50% on an approval rating, and the disapproval rating was in the mid-40s. And that's basically flipped. And we can use a number of different sources. I'll share the two that I follow in case you want to follow at home. I follow Nate Silver's Silver Bulletin Substack and Real Clear Politics. They also do a summation of the polls. So these are averages, not a particular poll. It's average of all the polls. They are telling virtually the same story, which isn't really a surprise because they're looking at the same data. A week ago, if we had spoken, we probably would have found an even wider gap than exists today. It's a disapproval rating that's above 50%, 51, 52%, and an approval rating that's now even further below 50% at somewhere around 44 or 45, depending on, you know, who you follow. Basically the same numbers. I think these, though, hide a few interesting other pieces that we should be following. And you asked about like the trajectory relative to the first term. It's basically the same. So there's not a whole lot of difference, but it is also, like the first term, a more difficult start to a term than what we've seen historically, almost across the board since Truman. If we look a little bit inside these numbers at some of the issues, I think it's interesting because the issues that really mattered in the election where, you know, the candidates had very different platforms and they had even different track records to bring to bear for voters to decide on. I would say it's inflation, the economy, and immigration were the three top issues. And then you could add into that maybe some lingering grievances on the trade front. But on all four of those, including immigration, which is, you know, kind of at the 50-50 line, they're showing a net disapproval. The worst is on inflation. The second worst is on trade. The third worst is the economy. And then immigration is a bit split. And we know, of course, that this is also very much influenced by, you know, your political party that you tend to support. The numbers are not that different. It's obvious, you know, which party's pulling in which direction. But I would just kind of look to some other data on, you know, strongly disapprove versus strongly approve. You know, because this is also telling you something about the political party, and the strong disapproval is right around 42%, and the strong approval is at call it 27. So that just says, you know, what's his like threshold kind of low point for popularity, because he's got, you know, some people who will support him no matter what, and it's you know, probably in the 30s, somewhere around there, maybe a little bit less. But so we're trending lower. We're trending towards the average of the first term, and it's on these key issues related to the economy and increasingly even immigration.
So as I was looking through the POTUS 47 update, one bar graph in particular jumped out at me, which referenced the quantity of executive orders versus bills signed by the president over the past few months. So, Kirk, could you put some numbers around this for us and speak to how the figures measure up against recent prior administrations, including, of course, Trump 1.0?
Yeah, sure. So the report also that you're referencing is on a site that I would like to share, which is www.ubs.com/POTUS47. That's POTUS for President of the United States, and then 47 altogether. And it's our first 100 days report. So you can access the report there. And yeah, so what I found interesting when you looked at the number of executive orders, which is, you know, effectively governing from the executive branch, versus laws passed, which is governing because there's legislation that's been approved by both chambers of Congress and then signed into law by the president. You see two very stark observations. The first is on executive orders, it's in an atmosphere or stratosphere all unto itself. We've never seen in the first 100 days activity like this, where over 140 executive orders were passed. That is really, you know, it's rare by historical standards to see even, you know, call it a couple dozen in the first couple, first 100 days. So really in a whole new world unto itself. And so I was even wondering a little bit about that, which is, you know, why are we seeing such a large number of executive orders? And there may be something of an urgency about getting the agenda across the line, not wanting necessarily to wait for policy to become law. And maybe also because 15% of the executive orders were related to trade, and the president has probably no confidence that Congress would be wanting to legislate a rise in tariff rates, then he's using the executive orders. And some of these executive orders to implement tariffs have never been used before, at least the legal precedent. Like, if you look at the International Economic Emergency Powers Act, that is primarily the tool that the president has used in these executive orders to raise tariffs, and that's never been done before. Five laws. So five laws, typically by this point in a president's term, you'll have seen, you know, again, a couple dozen or less, like somewhere between, you know, 10 and 20 laws. So fewer laws passed, and that may be a reflection of the narrow majorities that exist in Congress. It may be that Congress has been really absorbed with having to figure out the reconciliation package, which they've been, not just that, but also the confirmations of key people within the executive branch, so key appointments. So that is, you know, taking up a lot of the energy within the halls of Congress, maybe limiting the degree to which we are seeing legislation come through, but also there's just been a general lack of bipartisanship on most issues. We have just not seen that reach across the aisle to pass laws. That may change over time, but an administration that's determined to get things done and using the power of the executive branch to do that. And we've seen in some cases that the courts have disagreed with the president's use of executive order and have made some motions to check that authority.
So with all of that in mind, I'm curious, and perhaps from the perspective of the administration, what would you cite, Kurt, as being some notable wins and perhaps some notable challenges over these first 100 days?
Yeah, well, one of the charts that we show in this report is the number of encounters at the southern U.S. border. That's really ground to a halt. It was running between 2021 and 2024 at an average rate of, let's call it, 200,000 encounters a month. And because of the asylum rules that were in place through much of that time, the read across is that most of the people that were encountered at the southern border, were allowed in to the U.S. With the court documents or with the court dockets on asylum, several months long, maybe years, that was limiting the pathway to citizenship. But the president's arrival, together with some of the sort of later term moves of the Biden administration, has brought that number from 200,000 a month to, I think in March it was 11,000. So that national emergency that the president declared day one at the southern border, has been largely remedied, at least when it comes to measuring it through border encounters that the Customs and Border Protection Service has had. So I'd put that maybe as a win. Now, of course, you've heard when Congress went back to meet with their constituents, something they heard a lot about was concern about the wrongful deportation. And then, of course, the Supreme Court and, kind of weighing in on this. So that's something that is maybe taking away. We were talking earlier about immigration as a general subject, and that's kind of right at the 50-50 line. I think it's these other issues that are maybe weighing on the, people considering immigration broadly as a success. But when you narrow it down to the southern border, that would be one. When we think about the other maybe challenges, if you will, I don't think we have to be too creative here. It's really around tariffs, not just the magnitude, but also the variability. So tariffs imposed on Canada and Mexico, 25% with very few exemptions, to be reversed just 48 hours later. The reciprocal tariff announcement then being on pause for 90 days. These are the kinds of things that have been weighing on sentiment, weighing on financial markets, quite possibly weighing on the president's approval rating, and also making, as we heard yesterday, the Federal Reserve's job about, communicating monetary policy and thinking about the next phase of monetary policy very, very difficult. So that is why, sitting here today, one of the key issues that everybody is following to see is what does the president do on these tariffs that are so high with China that it's effectively an embargo, and what does he do with the other bilateral trading relationships that may yield a deal or may yield a further ratcheting up of tensions. So this is all playing out in real time, but that's what the market's really focused on, because it's been the chief factor behind the revisions and estimates for the year about the economy and financial markets.
In terms of how trade policy has been impacting the economy, markets, how have conditions fared over the past few months? Again, as we're recording today here on Thursday, May 8th, we recently have been seeing a bit of a rebound in U.S. equity markets. So as we look forward, what are CIO's expectations through the balance of 2025 in terms of how economic market conditions evolve and the main drivers behind them?
Yeah, they've already worsened quite a bit. The outlook for the economy had been somewhere slightly above 2% for the year 2025, and they're now, you know, down closer to 1.5%. I'm speaking about also our own forecast as well as median economist forecasts. If you look at inflation, that's actually, you know, there's really no argument that inflation has come down. Right now it's sitting at a level that's only slightly above the Fed's target. But the view was that inflation for the year was going to be in the mid twos or slightly lower than that, not at the Fed's target, but definitely much better controlled than it was a year or 2 years ago. That is now forecast to go back up above 3% because, as most of us know, tariffs are inflationary. And at these levels, the level we estimate is that the effective tariff rate in the U.S. went from 2.5% to just under 25%. If it's, again, magnitude, duration, so how high, how long. And if they stay at these levels for a long period of time, then we'll probably see even lower GDP figures and even higher inflation numbers, because I think baked into some of these forecasts for 2025 is a view that the tariffs are going to rolled back to some degree. We saw the announcement this afternoon or this morning with the UK. Light on details, some of these memorandums of understanding are the international legal equivalent of a handshake, but nonetheless, it takes the temperature down. And so at the beginning of the year, estimates for the S&P 500 and for earnings would have suggested, high single digits earnings growth, and an S&P 500 that ended the year at 6,600. And we're now at a basically flat earnings figure for this year and a target of 5,800. And of course, we can, these are subject to revision based on the direction of the tariffs and the related uncertainty. And I should point out, it isn't just about the magnitude and duration. I made a mistake there. It's more than that. It's the variability too. You know, it's the fact that it's hard to know what to plan for if you can't have any certainty on input costs and other price measures, where to make an investment, how much inventory to hold, how much working capital, how many employees. So all of this is in flux. Potentially right now, companies are more, rightfully in a more of a paralysis state. The idea would be that as the year progresses and we get some reduction in the rates and maybe less variability, that companies are then once again able to re-engage and plan. We keep hearing across the board. It hasn't shown up in the real data yet, but on almost all survey measures, companies are saying they're having a tough time planning. Their guidance has been revised down. They're doing much more scenario planning. That is exactly what, is sort of feeding through into the economic data, expectations for the year, expectations for financial markets.
So turning back to the administration, we're already, of course, in it, though. What might the next 100 days have in store for the Trump administration? And that can span legislative priorities, further executive actions, even foreign policy focuses.
Yeah, so the next 100 days gets us into something like, late July, early August. I haven't done the numbers, but I'm just going to say, the heat of the summer. And by then, I do think we're going to have had a lot happen on the tariff front. I think we should be watching what happens in the courts. There's a large docket of lawsuits they're facing off in the Court of International Trade. They're going to have oral arguments on Wednesday, I believe that's, or Tuesday, May 13th, I believe it. But, you know, the timing of any move, if there was an injunction or if the IEEPA tariffs, the International Economic Emergency Powers Act that was used to legislate these tariffs that are, or not legislate, but order these tariffs, the, if they were to be enjoined or declared illegal, then that could be sort of a sudden force of a rollback in the tariffs. And the administration can come back at it in different ways. Think of some of the traditional measures around Section 232 or Section 301. Those are still available, but it just means, you know, more time because these require a review. Can't be as sweeping, probably fewer products. Oh, and by the way, there are already investigations happening on semiconductors and pharmaceuticals. We may, by the next 100 days, hear something about that. It's a little early. Typically, it takes longer, but should be on our radar screen. And then the other is, we haven't talked about, but it's around the tax cut extension. And there were some pretty ambitious goals of getting the tax cuts extended, at least a bigger framework, you know, in place by July 4th. Judging by the latest negotiations, and by that I mean some of the efforts to cut Medicaid spending, they were you know, gearing up for potentially $800 billion. Seems like they're hitting quite a bit of friction at the, you know, $300 billion mark. The less they're cutting from Medicaid means they have to cut elsewhere or scale back the tax cut and ambitions, the extension, and then the additional tax cuts. When we think about some of the, there's some pressure building on state and local taxes from Republicans that are representing from blue states. You know, that's also causing, because if you're lifting the SALT cap deduction, state and local tax deduction, if you lift that, that's less revenue. So if you're collecting less revenue, all of this just means either you've got to shrink the tax cut extension and not give as many additional tax cuts, or you have to accept a higher deficit as a share of GDP. And there's a big question as to not just whether Congress, and in particular the House, would allow for that, narrow majorities, but also will the bond market allow for that? Because, you know, prolonged deficits that are at a high level or at a high level and growing, and we've seen some pretty sinister moves in the bond market over the past month and a half, you know, that could be something that comes around and short circuits the legislative process. You know, so there's, and the debt limit is also in there. And we don't know the X date for the debt limit, meaning the time when the Treasury runs out of money. So these are all the things that, you know, that are at least on my, you know, my punch list for what to follow over the next 100 days. It will surely be as interesting and as the first 100 days, that I can tell you with, you know, reasonable certainty.
Well, Kurt, this was a great touch base. Thank you for dropping by Top of the Morning today to keep our listeners, our clients informed on how the UBS Chief Investment Office is interpreting the takeaways from President Trump's second term in office, 100 days in, and how the policy has been impacting markets, the economy. As you pointed out, there will be much else to discuss in the weeks and months ahead. So looking forward to our next catch up in June. Thank you again, Kurt, for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Dan.
Absolutely. Again, today we have been joined by Kurt Ryman, Head of Fixed Income for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. As Kurt pointed out, to you, our listeners, and especially our clients of UBS, please be sure to reference the website ubs.com/POTUS47, which is updated with resources, insights from the UBS Chief Investment Office on a frequent basis. From UBS Studios, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.